And let's get early business news now. Here's Brian Finn.
Fran, thank you. Shares in Facebook hit a record high last night after the social media company reported a 140% rise in net income for the 3 months to the end of June. Overall revenue of $2.9 billion was up 60% and above Wall Street targets. Ads on mobile devices now account for 62% of advertising revenue for Facebook. This is a spectacular shift given that mobile ads accounted for practically nothing 2 years ago. The company now has 1.3 billion active users every month, up 14% on last year. Of these, more than a billion are on mobile devices. Shares were up around 5% to just above $75 in after-hours trading, giving the company a valuation of around $190 billion. The country's CEOs are very optimistic about our economic prospects, according to a survey from PwC this morning. Around 86% say they are positive about the outlook for the Irish economy. That's up from 31% last year. Just over three quarters of the 256 business chiefs surveyed said they were optimistic about the future prospects for their own business, up from 44% last year. Meanwhile, a report from Grant Thornton shows that Ireland continues to outperform in attracting foreign direct investment. The report indicates that global FDI inflows are estimated to reach $1.8 trillion in 2015 and that Ireland is well positioned to take advantage of this. The economic recovery and the quality of the workforce are pull factors, it says, but skill shortages and the cost of doing business here could be a deterrent, it warns. Hibernia REIT has indicated that it may be close to making another acquisition in Dublin City. In a statement to the Stock Exchange this morning, it says it's in discussions to acquire Cumberland House. It's a seven-storey office building of 112,000 square feet located close to Merrion Square. Drinks Group Britvic has reported group revenue of £329.5 million for the 12 weeks to July 6th, an increase of 4% on the same period last year. Great Britain revenue was up 4.6%, but Ireland revenue was down 2.5%, but volume was up by 1%. Just finally on the currencies, the euro buys $1.34.5 and 79 pence sterling, Fran.
Brian, thank you for that. Fiona Kelly's here now and she's going to tell us what it says in today's papers.
It's a mixed bag of headlines in this morning's front pages. The Irish Independent leads with yesterday's liquidation of Bearhaven Credit Union in Cork, taking the line that the central bank has urged the country's 3 million credit union members not to panic, since yesterday's news does not have any impact on members' savings in any other credit union. While on its front page, the Irish Examiner reports that the board of the credit union in question has said that it is not in the public interest to wind it up. The Examiner leads today, meanwhile, with a special county-by-county health report. The paper has also published a supplement to accompany what it describes as its data mining exercise. Some of the findings highlighted are that death rates from breast cancer are highest in Waterford, the highest rate of suicide is in Cork City, while Limerick City has the highest rate of infant mortality. Minister told to rein in spending and allow for tax cuts. That's the lead headline in today's Irish Times, which reports from yesterday's last cabinet discussion before the summer holidays. The Irish Daily Mail leads with comments made by Robert Watt, the Secretary General of the Department of Public Expenditure at the McGill Summer School yesterday, that it should be made easier to sack underperforming civil servants. Mr. Watt also said that a job for life in the civil service is not going to happen in the future. Today's Herald leads with the high-speed crash between Gardaí and burglars outside Portlaoise yesterday. The two Gardaí who were recovering from the crash last night managed to arrest the four men who had earlier failed to stop for officers in Cork and drove from a petrol station without paying in Portlaoise. The chase ended when the high-speed BMW car which the men were driving crashed into the Garda car before turning over. And we're also told that between them, the four men have 200 previous convictions. The Irish Daily Star leads today with a story which claims that cash-strapped prison bosses have drafted in an inmate who is currently serving a 5-year sentence for drug crimes to drive a bus with other inmates on board from Mountjoy Prison to Thornton Hall. The inquest into the death of Peaches Geldof, which receives coverage in all of this morning's papers, provides the lead story in today's Irish Sun. Peaches Geldof overdosed on high-strength heroin after hiding the drug in her loft and lying that she had quit, the paper reports, also noting that the strength of her overdose was 10 times that which killed her mother, Paula Yates, when she died of an overdose in 2000. Elsewhere on the front pages, the Times reports on yesterday's meeting of the Banking Inquiry Advisory Group. The paper reports that the group advised that the investigation should look back over the past 20 years to discover the origins of the economic crash, but that there has been disagreement on the cross-party committee about the scope and time frame of the inquiry. The good weather provides lots of pictures in this morning's papers, but the Times and Independent run with front page pictures taken by photographer Colin Keegan at a sun-kissed Portmarnock beach in Dublin yesterday. But finally, the Times and Independent both report today on how vandals sprayed red paint all over the newly located Molly Malone statue at Suffolk Street in Dublin yesterday morning. The statue has just received a €50,000 makeover and steam clean. So Dublin City Council was keen to get Molly back looking her finest, which they did by mid-afternoon yesterday. And the CEO of Dublin City Business Association, Richard Guiney, tells today's Independent that graffiti is an escalating problem in the city and that last year they spent €125,000 removing graffiti, which was the equivalent in mass to twice the size of the Aviva Stadium.
Quite a picture from Eric Luke in the Times as well this morning. Fiona Kelly, thank you. As the fighting continues in Gaza, yesterday the United Nations Human Rights Council Ireland abstained from a vote proposing an investigation into possible war crimes in the area. Navi Pillay, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, said yesterday, "There seems to be a strong possibility that international law has been violated in a manner that could amount to war crimes. So why would Ireland abstain from a vote to inquire into potential war crimes?" The Irish Ambassador to the UN, Patricia O'Brien, said yesterday, "The motion proposing an inquiry was, quote, unbalanced, inaccurate and prejudges the outcome of the investigation by making legal statements." She went on to say that it also failed to condemn explicitly the indiscriminate firing of rockets into Israeli civilian areas. Fianna Fáil Senator Avril Power isn't happy. Good morning.
Morning.
You've described the abstention as utterly shameful. What's shameful about calling for balance when you're possibly investigating war crimes?
Because the Irish government should have used its voice to stand up for the people of Palestine, where 150 children have been killed by Israel over the last 2 weeks. We've had a situation where Israel, in its campaign against the entire Palestinian population of Gaza, has killed 650 people, most of whom are civilians. Where, on the other hand, Hamas, and I condemn the actions of Hamas in sending out rockets, has killed two civilians. And I think an attempt to portray the impact of both Israel and Hamas as being equal, I think is wrong. I think it gives cover to what Israel is doing. And yet, the UN Commissioner for Human Rights, in speaking on the motion, was critical of both Israel and Hamas, but reserved the vast bulk of her speech for Israel because of what Israel is doing. She criticised them for targeting hospitals, for killing two people in wheelchairs in a centre for the disabled, for killing four children on the beach with targeted airstrikes, and for killing another three children the next day with drone strikes on their house. So that's what Israel is doing.
But how can a body
is reluctant to call them out on that. That is a war crime.
But how can a body like this, like the United Nations Human Rights Council, ignore one element of this and entirely look at it from one particular angle?
They weren't ignoring one element. As I said, the Commissioner for Human Rights criticised both. But the reason why the motion is targeted at Israel is because Israel has killed more than 300 times as many Palestinians over the last few weeks.
The High Commissioner said, in fact, that some of the activities of Hamas could also be considered war crimes. Yeah. So why then
not
be examined?
And I agree with that. But obviously where you have 650 dead Palestinians shows a mass orchestrated campaign by the Israeli government against Palestinian civilians, including children. And it's the scale of that violence that means that the UN should target the bulk of their energies on stopping Israel's campaign of terror.
I'm just failing to figure out why you should ignore one war crime over another.
They're not ignoring one over the other. The Human Rights Commissioner criticised both. But the reason why the motion was specifically targeted at Israel is because, as I said, Hamas has killed two civilians, Israel has killed 650. It has used weapons which are designed to target entire areas, not individuals. And the Commissioner also made it very clear in her speech that while Israel has a right to defend itself, and of course it does, and I accept Israel's right to defend itself, response to any threat must be proportionate, must be targeted against the people who are actually threatening it and must also involve safeguards for civilians. Israel is not doing that, and under international law, that is the definition of a war crime. Where a military campaign is directed at a civilian population, that's a war crime.
Ireland wasn't the only country to abstain. They did so in line with other European Union members. What do you have to say about that?
I think, some of the countries that have abstained aren't too surprising. They've traditionally would be seen as pro-Israel. I think the difference with Ireland's abstention is that traditionally we have always stood up for the Palestinian people. We've always been clear and unequivocal in our condemnation of Israel's ongoing illegal occupation of Palestine, which is against dozens of UN motions. I'm against their blockade of Gaza. I was in Gaza myself last year. I saw the impact of Israel has basically built a huge barrier around all of Gaza so that people can't get in or out. And within that, people don't have access to clean water. They can't farm their own land.
And
they can't
fish. That's all been well documented. But within that, you have Hamas and other militant groups who are firing out rockets, not just homemade amateur-type rockets, but also highly sophisticated weaponry as well, with long range, into Israel, almost striking the main airport in Tel Aviv. You cannot ignore that. Surely.
Absolutely not. And
why did you criticise the government for abstaining on what they see as an imperfect motion?
Because the government should have, if the government wanted to also draw attention to Hamas's actions, the government should have supported the motion so that inquiry can take place into the scale of Israel's war crimes in Gaza. It could then have used its speech, our ambassador's speech, to also criticise Hamas. But to equate the two, as Desmond Tutu has said, if you're neutral in situations of injustice, you've chosen the side of the oppressor. And if Ireland has now changed
but
its
Ireland
foreign policy...
But Ireland has not done that, Eivor Power, because the ambassador quite clearly criticised both sides in her address.
In refusing to vote with the bulk of international opinion, which is that what Israel has done deserves to be investigated, that targeting disabled people
deserves to be investigated. It seems to me you're criticising the government for not going with the flow as opposed to insisting that a motion should be more thorough.
No, when it came down to it, they had a decision to vote for the motion or to not. As I said, they could have added extra reservations on top of that, but I don't accept that they should have voted against the motion. And I think it's in stark contrast to the position that the Irish government took during Israel's assault on Gaza in 2009, when we had no qualms in being critical of Israel for what it was doing. We didn't feel the need to qualify every sentence by talking about Israel's right to self-defence, because the right to self-defence does not cover killing children.
What's changed?
Government policy has clearly changed, and I think that's wrong. And I think it's out of touch with the fact that the vast majority of Irish people are horrified by what's going on. They accept that Israel has a right to defend herself, but they don't think it's right that means torturing children, murdering children. In open air, the children that were killed on the beach last week, according to the UN Commissioner for Human Rights, were targeted. The children that were killed on the roof of their house was by a drone attack. This is incredibly sophisticated military technology that's designed to pinpoint targets and kill them. And that technology is being used against children. In that situation, there's nothing for us to be neutral about.
This has happened. It's done. So what can the government do to rectify it, as you see it?
I think the government needs to start speaking out about the injustice that's taking place against the Palestinian people.
But you did that yesterday. The ambassador raised those issues yesterday.
About the root causes of this conflict and putting pressure on Israel and also on the US as a country that has a lot of influence on Israel to end its blockade of Gaza. And I also think the European Union needs to stand out much more stronger. I was disappointed with the overall European position. If you contrast that with Europe's attitude to Ukraine, where they've had no hesitation in imposing sanctions on the Russians for what they're doing in Ukraine, and compare that to Gaza, where we've this bland non-position as a continent, it's wrong. It shows just a moral ambivalence that we've seen elsewhere in the world and other places before, like Europe's reaction to Bosnia, and our refusal to actually get involved and to stand up with the Bosnian people when it mattered. We are deeply ashamed of that now when we look back in our history. But now, as things stand in Gaza, we have a chance to act, and we should.
All right, Fianna Fáil, Senator Eivor Power, thank you for that. We should say we did ask the Minister for Foreign Affairs, Charlie Flanagan, to speak to us this morning, but he wasn't available.
The leader of Hamas has said he's willing to accept a truce in Gaza to allow humanitarian aid into the region. But when it comes to a ceasefire. Khaled Mashal wants terms that are unlikely to be acceptable to Israel. In the last 2 weeks of fighting, more than 700 Palestinians, 32 Israeli soldiers and 3 Israeli civilians have died. Well, Jonathan Miller is Channel 4's foreign affairs correspondent. He's in Gaza this morning. I spoke to him just a couple of minutes ago and began by asking him what happened overnight.
Well, it was a very heavy night of bombing and shelling, Claire. We understand from the Israeli Defense Forces that they have struck 35 what they call terror targets across Gaza overnight. And this has now led to a really shocking rise in the number of Palestinians killed. Last night, it was standing at 485, and I was saying it was creeping inexorably towards 500. The death toll here in Gaza now, after, I think, 6 days of sixteen days of conflict, is now 715 Palestinians dead and 4,600 injured. As you probably know, the vast majority of those people are civilians, among them a large number of women and children. In fact, yesterday, among the 485 who were dead, more than 140 of those were children. So the impact that's being felt on normal, ordinary civilians here in Gaza is immense. But Israel continues to pound its targets, continues to try to knock out the missile launch sites, the missile storage sites, and destroy the tunnels.
So is the most damage being done now, and what you saw overnight, is that the ground offensive that's doing all of this damage and harm and causing the loss of life?
Oh no, there are many, many ways that the Israelis are doing this. There is the ground offensive. The ground offensive is largely either the destruction of the tunnels and the detonation of those. I don't think that is what is raising the numbers killed. Or they're engaging with Hamas militants and other militant groups like Islamic Jihad and the Palestine Resistance Committees. Those firefights may kill a few militants and indeed Israeli soldiers, as we know. But I think that the real damage done is by the airstrikes and the shelling, both of those together. The naval bombardment has been intense. You really learn the sounds of Gaza. You hear the sharp crack of the naval shells as they're being fired from about a mile or half a mile offshore, and then like a second later you get the thump of the shell landing. There's tank shelling coming in from the east from the ground forces and artillery there, but I think most damaging of all are the F-16 strikes, big missiles which take out whole houses, as well as the drone strikes. Which are smaller rockets in confined spaces, which explode in confined spaces and kill the occupants of a flat, maybe, but don't bring down the whole building. All of these things together are being used in concert by the Israeli military, as I think they really feel the international pressure possibly building, the demands for some sort of truce or ceasefire building, and they want to try to get as much done as they possibly can in the time available.
What's the appetite there on the ground for a truce or ceasefire? Because, as you say, negotiations are continuing many miles away from there in relation to the terms, Jonathan. But do people want that now?
Well, it's a yes and no answer, Claire. I mean, there's nothing that the people of Gaza want more than peace. I can tell you that. But, a truce would allow, a humanitarian truce, as they call it, would allow people to go shopping. It means that people can come out of their homes and go to the markets and stock up, because most people are just cowering in terror in their own homes. A ceasefire is a very different thing. And last night, Khaled Mashal, the head of Hamas, who's exiled in the Gulf state of Qatar, he said in a speech that Hamas was prepared to accept a humanitarian truce, but would not. Agree to a ceasefire unless the terms were negotiated first. And Hamas is sticking to its terms, and its terms are primarily A, stop the hostilities, B, lift this absolutely crippling 7-year-long siege of Gaza, which has devastated the local economy, caused 50% of the working population to be out of work, and it's destroyed the whole business environment. It means there are no prospects for young graduates leaving universities. It has been a terrible thing to witness. It's really, really painful for the people living here. And Hamas, and I think I would actually put my hand on my heart and say that I don't think I've met a single ordinary person here, not people linked to Hamas, but ordinary people who say, we cannot have another ceasefire which doesn't sort this out. We need to live in dignity and we need our rights respected. So they are seemingly behind this resistance.
Jonathan Miller there, Channel 4's foreign affairs correspondent, speaking from Gaza a little earlier. Back home, the government wrapped things up yesterday with a final cabinet meeting before the summer break. But before ministers could pack their trunks and head for the hills, there were a number of important issues to sort out. Daniel McConnell, political correspondent with Independent Newspapers, is here now to go through the various decisions that were made and announcements that we heard about yesterday. Daniel, you're very welcome.
Morning, Claire.
I suppose the first one, and most importantly for most people, is the budget. And the government wants to deliver a less harsh budget in 2015. Are the numbers beginning to add up?
They certainly seem to be. And all the mood music from government in recent weeks has been that a budget significantly lower than the $2 billion previously stated target will be achievable. Certainly we know that the initial process of bilateral meetings and certainly the kind of negotiations between Brendan Howland's Department of Public Expenditure and the other line departments have begun in recent weeks. We know that Brendan Howland had sought basically initial sort of ideas where savings could be cut or could be made. He had sought a package of about 5% off the total government spending. We know that government departments haven't quite delivered on that because they essentially think that, you know, there's money to be spent there. So Brendan Howland himself is saying he's having to manage expectations. You know, while there's a less harsh budget on the way, there still is an adjustment to be made.
But in order to deliver any sort of a tax break, spending will have to be reined in. It's got to come from somewhere, right?
Absolutely. That was a very strong message from both Brendan Howland and Michael Noonan yesterday, is that, you know, ministers will have to dampen their expectation in terms of a loosening of their budgets in order to deliver on those tax promises, because certainly the government has raised expectations that there will be kind of moves to lessen the tax burden in the October's budget. If they don't deliver on that, then I think there'll be a backlash against it. So they have to come up some way to find the money to deliver a way of reducing, as they said in the restatement of government priorities, they need to lessen that marginal rate of 52%.
There was an interesting blog written by Brendan Howland on his department website last night. I don't know if you saw it.
I did.
Just pointing out that the health spend hasn't dropped significantly since 2011. Without saying anything, the implication there is, Leo, you're going to have to work within your means here.
Yeah, and this is kind of in the context that since taking office, Leo Varadkar has stressed very strongly the idea of realistic budgets in health. I think the point Brendan Howland was making, that, you know, we've heard repeatedly on shows like this and everywhere else in newspapers, you know, the crisis in health because of cuts and repeated cuts. I think the point Brendan Howland was making is that, you know, when you take in supplementary estimates or the additional sort of bailouts that they've gotten at the end of every year, spending has remained pretty static. Mm-hmm. And that reflects, I suppose, the difficulties in trying to get the health budget under control.
Absolutely. Okay, we're at 7:30 and time for the headlines, but we'll take them in just a moment because there are a couple of other issues, Daniel, that we wanted to touch on as well. Free GP care. Plans are pushing ahead for free GP care.
They are. Minister Varadkar got permission yesterday to draft legislation. We're told that legislation, which will bring free GP care for the over 70s, will be delivered by the end of the year or early next year. And essentially, so he's gone away and his department will go away and do that. There was some discussion about the under 6s, but obviously they still have to get agreement from the GPs, and there doesn't seem to be any sign of that in the near future. So that's you've almost got a twin track approach there at the moment, but certainly in terms of the over 70s, we're looking at the end of the year.
Okay, and water charges, there will be some concessions for those who are less well
off.
Yeah,
Taoiseach Joan Burton revealed yesterday that the government have agreed the €100 package for low income families, carers and those with disabilities, that essentially the government will pay them or give them an additional €100 to offset the cost of water charges. It'll be paid quarterly, so you'll get €25 every 3 months. The package itself is likely to cost in the region of £42 to £44 million in total. But what Joan Burton was saying yesterday is that combined with the free allowance for children, it should offset by and large the cost of water for those low income families.
But the costs are adding up, aren't they?
They are, and certainly, you know, with the abolition of the standing charge in Irish Water, seeking to reduce that child's allowance, there's no clarity as of yet as to exactly what the costs are likely to be. We're like, hopefully we'll get them in due course.
And the banking inquiry, separately to the cabinet meeting, the Oireachtas Banking Inquiry Committee made some decisions yesterday on the blueprint.
They did. They've agreed, I suppose, three broad modules as to how they'll conduct their work. They will have one looking at banking itself, the role of banking, then another one looking at supervision, and the third, probably the most interesting one, is the one looking at the policy response. Now, there was a bit of a disagreement at the inquiry yesterday meeting about as to what sort of the sequencing of these things will happen, because obviously there's a concern that given there's only 18 months left of this government term, it mightn't get to the end of it, and you know, there's some political row as to when we want to see the likes of Brian Cowan and senior ministers and senior officials come in. Do you want it at the start or at the end? The feeling, if it's put at the end, then it's likely they won't ever come.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Daniel McConnell, thank you very much indeed, political correspondent with Independent News and Media.
And the government has signed off on plans to extend free GP care over the next 3 years. All children and everyone over the age of 70 will come under the scheme a little bit behind schedule. The new Minister for Health, Leo Varadkar, confirmed the measures.
We do need to agree a contract with the GPs. Both Fine Gael and Labour and the government are very committed to universal primary care. We want to make that the hallmark reform of our health services. But I also want to do it in cooperation with GPs. I don't want a situation whereby they feel overwhelmed or under-resourced. And I've worked in general practice for many years. So I think it's important to take a few months to get it right. But it is absolutely my intention, certainly by the end of the year or early next year, to have access to your GP without a charge for those at the extremes of age, preschool children and people over 70, who are the ones who use our primary care and our GP services the most.
What the Health Minister had to announce, undoubtedly good news for patients, but what about the system and its ability to deal with the change? Steve Thomas is an Associate Professor at the Centre for Health Policy and Management at Trinity College and is on the line. Good morning.
Good morning.
Do we know how much extending GP care to all children and over 70s is going to cost?
We do. I mean, it probably works out at around about 100 million over 3 years. If you take the under sixes, then you add in all primary school age and secondary school age children, and then the over 70s. So actually, if you think that we've already got 39 million already earmarked for the first phase of this, we're looking at probably equivalent amounts or even slightly less over the next 2 years to get that in place. So it is quite affordable.
And relative, not all that expensive, really.
Really not. And it's the kind of thing that you say, well, why wasn't this done earlier? And certainly within the Celtic Tiger years, this would have been a blink of an eye, really.
What about the ability of the system to cope? Do we have any idea about an increase in demand?
Yes, I mean, I think the probably we were doing some workforce planning on this particular issue, and it, probably an increase of about 7% would be about right over the next 3 years. Now, that is, it's not insignificant, but it isn't overwhelming. I think it's something that the government needs to watch and monitor, and probably has to put in some policies to kind of boost the supply response, and it can do that either by increasing the number of practice nurses or thinking a little bit about how other healthcare professionals might take on some of the burden so that it doesn't all fall on GPs. But again, it's not unfeasible, and some of the rhetoric we've been hearing about the system being overwhelmed doesn't stack up with the actual data and indeed from international experience in other countries.
What about the planning of that increase in demand? Is there a possibility that a lot of this will, I suppose, happen by default, and in many cases GPs will be expected to just react and respond, that there won't be a coordinated government approach?
Well, I know the government's been looking at this for a number of years about what the supply responses or the different options for that needs to be. Clearly, it needs to kick in, as the Minister said. It needs to consult with GPs. It needs to look at different options. There are options on the table that have been employed in other countries. If it all falls back onto GPs, that will put them certainly under extra pressure. And one would then need to think about just being careful about the phasing and timing. And that's why you need some kind of effective evaluation and monitoring process over the next 2 years.
As we speak about GPs, we already know that consultation may be something of an issue, as we've seen over the past number of weeks between government and themselves and, in fact, the HSE. What about their willingness to cooperate with this? Because it could mean change, pretty significant change for some practices.
Yes, it certainly will mean a change. I think one obviously has sympathy with the GPs, as with other professional groups that have taken quite a big hit over the austerity period. And I think what's particularly front of their minds is the new GP contract that's coming up, which will shake things up. And so I think they're probably quite concerned about that. But I think if I was the government, I would be saying that really this isn't about cutting your incomes, it's about rolling out free GP care. And actually, because the cost items are not big, it would be quite possible, I think, for government to say that this will not, will not involve you losing money. We can, still preserve current levels, because this is actually more about extending universal healthcare and getting there than it is about squeezing you.
But how do you ensure that happens?
Well, I think that I think it's just a simple question of calculating what would GPs lose from private income, what would they gain through additional people being covered. I think it's just a question of doing some simple calculations and then building that into the actual contract and the contract negotiations.
Simple calculations sounds so easy, but we've been here before and we know what these negotiations can often result in.
That may be right, but from a technical point of view, it's not a difficult process. From a political point of view, it boils down to what, whether the stakeholders are willing, and perhaps it boils down to whether GPs want universal healthcare. Of course, the IMO has committed to universal healthcare, and now we're seeing it actually rolled out in practice. I think as long as it's done in a very measured and careful way and well-informed way, it is quite feasible and obviously very attractive.
I suppose probably the most relevant focus on this is to consumers, to householders, to parents of young children and to elderly people as well. What of the potential impact for people who are spending money visiting the GP?
Well, I think obviously for them it's good news, particularly for the under 60s and the over 70s. They use healthcare services a lot. It's been quite difficult for people over the austerity period. There's been quite a lot of quiet cost shifting from government back onto households. Households have had to pay more for different charges, more for drugs. So this is in a sense is a much better move. It's a move back in the right direction, and as I say, it's a stepping stone towards universal healthcare, where we can all go to the GP free at the point of contact.
All right, thanks for taking our call this morning. That's Steve Thomas from the Centre for Health Policy and Management at Trinity College in Dublin. Dez is here now at sport.
Yeah, good morning to you, Fran. St. Patrick's Athletic had a bit of a nightmare night last night. They crashed out of Europe, losing 5-0 in Tala against the Polish champions Legia Warsaw in the Champions League. The Pats manager, Liam Buckley, said they simply forgot to play in the second half and lost their shape. Now, they weren't helped by Ken O'Mahon getting injured in the warm-up, but 1-0 down at half-time, the visitors went on to score 4 more and comfortably progress to a tie with Celtic next week. The manager of the Polish side is the former Blackburn and Manchester United defender Henning Berg. Tony O'Donoghue asked him if he felt 6-1 on aggregate was a fair reflection on the tie.
I think we were a better team in both games. I think maybe the 1-1 result at our home did not reflect the game the way it should have been in result. And maybe this result did not properly reflect the way this game was. But I think overall we were the better team and we should have won at home but didn't. And today we scored maybe on our first chance, which was important. And when you are 2-0 up and they have to go for it, then of course it all opens up, and that is football. So we knew that this second leg, with the way the goal's going to go, will make a big difference in how the result's going to end.
That result will serve as a warning to Sligo Rovers. They host Rosenborg of Norway tonight. Now, like St. Pat's, Sligo achieved an excellent result in the away leg. They won 2-1, so there'll be a huge crowd at the showgrounds for the game, which kicks off at 7. Now, Rosenborg sacked their manager after losing to Sligo last week, and the Sligo captain, Alan Keane, told Adrian Eames that there could be a kickback.
Yeah, there can always be, because the players can take the blame probably for getting the manager sacked. It's never nice for the players to get a manager sacked, but they'll be looking to impress whoever's looking on for the new manager's role. As I said, we've just got to apply ourselves, and I'm sure they won't fancy coming here, tight pitch and stuff like that, and with the 3,900 fans here. So as I said, we just got to concentrate on our own game and take it from there.
Dundalk and Derry City are also in action, but they face very difficult tasks away from home. Derry are 1-0 down going to Shakhtar Soligorsk, and Dundalk 2-0 behind travelling to Hajduk Split. The Irish women's under 19 team are in semi-final action in the European Championships. Dave Connell's side take on the Netherlands in Oslo at 6 o'clock, and the Irish coach is optimistic.
Absolutely. Probably, like most of the games, we'll have a few nerves before the game because it's the longest part for myself and the players just waiting around, waiting for the kick-off. But really looking forward to it, and I really feel that we can get to a final.
And good luck to them in overnight friendly games. Manchester United were 7-0 winners over Robbie Keane's LA Galaxy. New signing Ander Herrera was the star. There were two goals each for Wayne Rooney, Ashley Young and Reece Jones. Liverpool lost 1-0 to Roma. Tottenham were 3-2 winners over Toronto. In cycling, it was the toughest day of this year's Tour de France. In Ireland, Stephen Roach made a gallant effort to win Stage 17. But in the end, victory went to his teammate, the 21-year-old Pole Rafael Majka, who takes the King of the Mountains jersey. Overall, Vincenzo Nibali still leads by 5.5 minutes. The good times continued for Wexford Hurling last night. They won the Leinster Intermediate Championship, beating Kilkenny at Nolan Park by 2-11 to 14 points. Antrim were easy winners over Down in the Ulster Under-21 Hurling Final, and Kildare beat Wicklow by a point in the Leinster Under-21A Hurling Final. Today's golfing action is split between the Russian Open and the Senior British Open Championship in Wales. In the early stages of the Russian Open, Damien McGrain is one shot off the lead. He's one under par after four holes. Kevin Phelan, Simon Thornton are level early in their rounds. And finally in racing, two meetings this evening, Limerick at 5.35 and Leopardstown Summer Thursday meeting begins at 5.25.
Des, thanks very much. There are some who claim today could be the hottest day of the year. Let's get the expert view from Met Air and Clara Finkela. Good morning to you.
Good morning and thank you. This morning, any mist or fog will soon lift. It will be mostly dry with good sunny spells. However, cloudier over parts of the southeast and west, with showers turning heavy and thundery with the risk of hail later. It will be very warm again, with top temperatures reaching between 22 and 27 degrees, and winds will be light variable or easterly. Tonight, the showers will gradually die out and it will become mainly dry with good clear spells. But some fog patches may form over the western half of the country. Lowest temperatures will fall to between 13 and 15 degrees and winds will be light variable or easterly. Friday will be mainly dry with good sunny spells, but scattered showers will break out later in the southwest. And sea fog may linger, especially along Atlantic coasts. It will continue to be very warm and humid, with top temperatures reaching between 24 and 27 degrees. Winds will be light variable or easterly, with onshore sea breezes developing in the afternoon. Saturday will be mostly cloudy, and with outbreaks of showery rain gradually clearing eastwards during the day. The rain could turn heavy or persistent for a time in the north, but drier and brighter weather in the southwest will extend further eastwards later. It will be cooler and fresher day with top temperatures of 18 to 23 degrees and light to moderate west to northwest breezes. There will be isolated showers on Sunday with some sunny spells, but it will be cooler and fresher with top temperatures returning to more normal values for the year and should reach between 17 and 20 degrees. Northwesterly winds will increase moderate to fresh. Monday will be mainly dry with some sunny spells, but becoming humid again with top temperatures in the high teens to low 20s. And to recap, today heavy thundery showers in parts of the southeast and west, very warm with top temperatures between 22 and 27 degrees. And that's the forecast. A very good day to you.